This episode of The Tour Life is also brought to you by Optimize Touring. If you're interested in learning how you can bring health and wellness on tour with you, whether it's a small van tour or a huge arena tour, go to optimizetouring.com to learn more. Welcome to The Tour Life podcast from Well Better Best. I'm Janine, your host, integrative nutrition health coach and personal trainer. In the past 10 years, I've had the privilege of meeting some of the most interesting and hardworking professionals in the music industry. Whether you are a fan of live music or someone who actually puts on the shows, you'll find some great stories, advice, and encouragement to live a happier, healthier life doing what you love. Today's guest is a tour manager who has worked with artists such as American Authors, Keizo, Toki Monsta, and Snails, among many others. In this episode, we talk about trusting your instincts, what it's like working in the EDM world, the importance of taking time off, and documenting your adventures. You can find him on Instagram at MarkClarkTM. Here is my conversation with one of my newest and amazing Southern friends, Mark Clark. Hey, Mark, thank you so much for joining me on the Tour Life podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
TM 101 was a little sparkle in your eye. So tell me a little bit about that, and then we'll get into a little bit more about you.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, it's not entirely funny how it came about. We're all kind of in the unfortunate circumstances of COVID-19, the new world, and adjusting to that. But we were all trying to find new ways to navigate the time and continue to give back. My foundations have always been about giving back, whether that's to my artists, my clients, and making a difference. And that goes for the touring community as well. I feel like we're one giant family. And I had seen some posts come up about trying to kind of give back in some capacity. I didn't really see anything yet about tour management, so I felt like maybe it was a time to throw it out there on the board. There's this touring community. There's a lot of them now, but there's this forum called BobNet where they kind of will put down job opportunities for the touring community, so on and so forth. And it's a forum where people can just talk about touring on the Facebook page. But it is a web-based kind of touring platform to find gigs. I put down a poster about tour management to see if anyone would be interested about learning about that. And I knew that there was a lot of incredible tour managers on BobNet and knew that this wasn't going to be a solo mission. I had put down there that if anyone would like to get involved, see if we can put something together. And I had noticed on the thread that Henry Bordeaux was one of the first to dial in on it and said he was interested. So he was kind of like the second, you know, me and him kind of were like the first people to be like, all right, we're communicating about this off the thread. Like, let's see if we can put something together here. And Jim Runge had chimed in about it. And then I had noticed a couple threads down, Doug Wilson, who you'd interviewed not too long ago, had done a post similar to teaching tour management. So we just brought him on with us. So I was like, hey, do you just want to come with us? And he ended up joining forces with us. So the first four were me, Henry, Jim, and Doug. And then we were collectively talking amongst each other how we want to put this together. And I think it was either Jim or Henry was like, let's bring in Adrian and MJ to do this. So that was kind of our core five going into TM 101. And as we would grow, we would eventually bring in 5-1 to be one of our special guests for some of our earlier episodes. And we just love 5-1 so much that we were like, we want you with us full time. So he joined us, and that kind of formed our kind of six crew that we, you know, co-host for TM 101. And they've just all been incredible. And the wild thing about it is that a lot of us I don't think all of us really knew each other. I know that some people did. I knew Jim Runge, but I didn't know anyone else, any of my other co-hosts before kind of this coming together. So it's been very special to to kind of unite and just know now some of these people, these co-hosts are my family now, essentially, you know, where I'm with them 4 days out of the week doing webinars. Yeah, I knew that it would evolve to something bigger than we could have ever imagined. I was like, if we do it right and our intent is true and we care about this thing, we can really kind of build out a cool platform and run with it. And I think it being well received right off the beginning was a good kind of match to get that thing going. Because, you know, everyone has their own agenda and how they're managing time, and it could have not been well received, and we could have not had a lot of people interested in it, and maybe it wouldn't have made it as far as it would today. But the initial response was crazy. That's why I was like, this thing can actually work, because people were like really amped for this thing to be a thing.
Tell me a little bit about how you got into the industry, because the fact that you decided that it would be a good idea to help other people, and that especially with education and mentorship at the core of it, tells me a little bit about your career. And I think it tells me that that sort of thing is important to you. So could you tell me how you got from never working in music to where you are today?
Mine was definitely the eager live behind the venue, and I'm gonna load out. I'm just here to work kind of person, you know. I was definitely a follower in the sense that I like graduated high school and then went with my friends to college, and I was trying to kind of like appease the parents, right? Like I was like, I'm gonna go to college. My parents were like, cheer, you know, were my biggest cheerleaders, and I was a daydreamer, you know, like when I was in the classroom, I'd look out the window. I just felt like I was in a rut, you know, like I was there and doing that thing, but it wasn't for me, you know, and that resonates for a lot of people. You know, college isn't really for everyone. It depends on where your heart's at, you know? And, as I got older, you know, I started being a little more exposed to music. I was a total MTV 90s kid, you know, young growing up, you know, I mean, I would be in junior high by the time I'd get to the early 2000s. But most of my childhood 90s, like the MTV thing was such a big thing. Mobile is where I grew up. I grew up in Mobile, Alabama, which is, for people that don't know, is kind of in between Atlanta and New Orleans. So from New Orleans, it's only 2 hours away. It's on the Gulf Coast. And it's 5 hours from Atlanta. So it's like right here on the Gulf of Mexico in between like Pensacola and not too far from New Orleans to give people kind of paint a picture. But where I was going with that is that it was kind of like a between market. You know, there wasn't a lot of tours that came through Mobile. So I wasn't really exposed to a lot of like the big city, like big tours that would normally come through a major city. So as I got older and would make my way to college, that's when I started getting more exposed to like the live concert setting and things like that. Once I was like, you know, junior in high school, once I was 16 and up, my parents were like, as soon as you can drive a car and you can go to your first concert, you know? As soon as I got my first car, you know, it was like full throttle. Like I'm going to see music. And as I got towards college, I would start joining like band street teams and stuff. So a lot of my earlier days was volunteering. I felt like that was like a no string approach to trying to get a foot in some capacity. I didn't really know what I wanted to do in music. I was like, hey, well, I'm a huge fan of these bands. I was like, they have opportunities to join their street team. I can put out flyers. I'm talking to their street team leader. I'm like engaging with these bands in some capacity. I thought it was such a huge thing. I was like, oh, I'm putting out the flyers. I'm like a part of the band, you know?
Well, that was like a gut feeling you had too, because if you didn't really know, you're like, well, this is a way to do it. So it's like your gut, your instinct already told you where to go.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of resources, you know? Like I didn't really know what was a right or wrong path to go. You know, a lot of people coming into the industry, whether they went to like Full Sail or went to like a music business program, they kind of have an idea of like what position they want to do. And they're like kind of moving in that direction. I didn't know what any of the positions were. I just was like, I'm a fan of these bands and like, I want to kind of be a part of whatever that is. You know, I didn't really know what any of the positions were. So that's kind of a twist to that, that when I came into the music business, I had no idea what I wanted to do. Touring wasn't even initially my forefront, you know, just being a part of music was my forefront and trying to make a difference in some capacity. So going back to continuing to present day, that was kind of my general foundations was how can I make a difference in the music industry? You know, I'm such a fan of these bands and their community, the fan community around this music and how they get back and cater to their fans. I was very influenced by that approach and how I could translate that over as a fan back to artists. Like, how can I turn this around? How can I give this experience back to an artist and teams and so on and so forth and give this awesome experience that makes this business fun? So that was kind of like my general foundations around it.
Definitely seems like it's worth to point out that passion for something, right? It's like you get a little bit of a pull towards something and then you start to become passionate about it and you start to really focus on it. And whether you know where it's going to end or not, most people don't know where that road's going to end, but they do know that something's pulling them toward that. And it seems to me that that's kind of how your career started to develop. It was kind of like you knew that you were passionate about something and you knew that you wanted to help people and you knew that you wanted to help whatever that whole thing was. And every time you made a decision, it kind of just kept pushing you toward this outcome.
Yeah, I think the biggest turn I noticed was when I started to put my chips on the table for music, right? I was trying to dabble too many different things at once. I was trying to please everyone besides myself. There was too much expectations for my family and friends alike to be on this path, right? And I think the reality around that wasn't my path. You know, I think once I've navigated, I was like a light bulb in my head that was like all these little things that I've been doing around music, finally kind of the puzzle pieces started coming to come together, being like, you know what, I need to just put all my chips down on this and really focus on whatever capacity I can do and try to make it in music in some way. My touring would amp up significantly. Mid 2014 there was a little stint, moved to Austin, all this energy, I'm gonna make it in the music business. Lo and behold, life didn't give me that right as I arrived. You know, I would be a busboy bar back working on Sixth Street for almost a year and a half before I caught a break. You know, it was kind of a lower point for me, but there was a lot of fun stories kind of building through that. But I was working on Sixth Street for a bit of time there. So not to name any names, we can go into stories, but to go to health and kind of fast forward a little bit, I would catch my first break. My touring would go from 0 to 100. I would get brought in as a tour manager. So finally, I had made it in my eyes. I was like, I've got a tour management gig. Like, this is good. We're making some traction. And touring would just go from 0 to 100 and just never slow down. So literally from 2014 through 2018 to maybe the last year, 2017, I just put on a lot of weight. And on top of that, mentally and physically, I was just gone. Like, I was super exhausted. I put my heart and soul into not taking no for an answer mentality. Tour manager, and that this is the opportunity for me to really set my feet and foundations on, like, I'm a tour manager now, like, I'm building my career portfolio and I'm a tour manager and like these are my clients and I'm their representation as their tour manager. So I took that really seriously. Like, I as soon as I got that opportunity, I was like, and after having a year and a half stint of having zero luck, I was like, I'm not failing. I will not fail.
were you almost ready to kind of just call it quits and then you got the opportunity, or what happened?
I would say my sign in Austin, Texas had to be David Geller. And I'll pass this to him whenever this podcast comes out. But David Geller is the manager for Thievery Corporation, and he needed help moving. And I had friended a handful of people in Austin, Texas during this time, and he needed help moving. And I showed up with my resume in hand and thought that he was one of the owners of C3. He was the biggest guy I had ever thought of that was in the music industry I could have ever thought of in that city. And since then, showing up and to help him, he put his arm around my shoulder, and he's been there for me ever since. So that was kind of a turning point. At least I felt like there was a light at the end of the tunnel from that point forward. I was very alone in Austin for a good bit of time, where I was like, I'm going to just try to do this. And I didn't really have a lot of people there to be, you know, to hang with and things like that. So I was very alone. And that was a good turning point. That gave me some hope, being like, okay, I finally feel like I'm connected to like music people in Austin, you know? And touring, things would just kind of improve from there. Literally everything, just like that, from that moment, things just started to kind of shift gears. Started getting introduced to his network. Opportunities would fall. I would end up flying out to work with this band in Colorado. And during this time, there's a big EDM boom going on. I wasn't a big electronic person. I didn't listen to electronic music prior to working in electronic. But I knew it was very prominent. I knew it was a thing that was coming up, and would cross paths with DJs at these festivals while working with bands. And they were just, it was very new for a lot of those DJs. They didn't have tour manager representation, and a lot of them needed help. So I was like, I'll help you guys. You know, like I showed up and was like, hey, I can help y'all. And just one thing led to another, and started reaching out to their management, and finally get on board. And that launched me into electronic. So mid 2014 was when I would break into EDM per se, you know. Like Savoy was kind of an electronic group, but they weren't like an official like EDM classification, like DJs traveling around like that. You know, we traveled still in van, trailer, Sprinter, so on and so forth.
You're right. With EDM, what I know from DJs that I know, a lot of them travel by themselves. And they're like, they go everywhere. Like they'll be like on one side of the world one day, and then like they'll fly to the opposite side. And it's really not like a regular, you know, rock band would be, right? Or how, like, explain a little bit kind of the difference between the two, and then kind of tell me like, what was your role in that, and how did that affect your life? Because I feel like the schedule might be a little bit different.
Yeah. Touring with bands is seasonal. You're going to get a very strong, you know, spring tour. You're going to have summer festival season. You're probably going to take a break come out of summer. You'll be building into the fall. And if you're lucky, you'll do a winter tour as well, you know, and then you'll have like a big New Year's Eve run kind of around that to kind of cap out the end of the year. But with electronic, I'll never forget the moment that I was told that I'm not going to be in a 15 passenger van. That was a very big moment in my life. I think I cried. They were like, yeah, you just fly everywhere. I was like, wait, we can fly to gigs? They're like, yeah, you just fly everywhere. I was like, I like hugged the manager. I was like, this is beautiful. I was like, this is crazy. I was like, do I sign in blood, or what is this? Is this it? This is like a devil. Are you the devil? And I'm signing my life over. There's a catch here.
That's sweet poetry, to be fair.
Right? It was such a moment. And I had been living in vehicles for so long that I didn't even know that was an option. Even when I would, even to get to my earlier band gigs, I would either take the bus to get to them to start. I didn't even fly. I didn't fly. I'd either drive my car to connect with them, or I would take a bus. So flying wasn't even really a concept in my world in touring yet. So that really was like the first big one was like, you don't travel with instruments and all these things. You can literally just backline them wherever you're going. And whether your artist is DJing on a laptop or just USB, that is all he's traveling with. And you'll literally just roll with him and that's what he's traveling with. And all that equipment you can backline for the event and it'll all be there for you when you show up. So that in itself was a huge gear shift in touring parties. That like, we're just going to fly everywhere. We're probably going to have the primary artist. To start off, I was with a group called Caked Up. To give you a kind of a little more emphasis, they were represented by CAA, same agent as the Chainsmokers. So we were doing a lot of co-bills with them at the time. So we were literally, it was like to the races as soon as they brought me on. Like, I mean, we were super busy and everywhere, like hit the ground running. And it's just straight to the airport, managing wild schedules, you know, like it's getting off the road was a little emotional for me. Sounding cliche, you know, or nerdy, but looking down from a plane on the at America and being like, you've driven all of this your entire life, practically, it feels like, was kind of a little emotional for me.
You're like looking out the window, just like,
I was like, that was a big path, you know, like to get to where I was, to be able to fly to a gig. I couldn't even realize, or, you know, like, I was like, this is a lot, you know, this is so cool. And the shows just got bigger and crazier and just never slowed down since that moment happened. And so to answer your question, yes, in EDM, there is seasons, but also where there is seasons, there's more accessibility. It's going to be more difficult to get in certain locations and certain things when you have to travel with all this gear and a trailer and a car and so forth, so on and so forth. And electronic, we can be anywhere, anytime. We're going to try and work out 3 shows in one day. Sure. Do the time zones work? Sure. We're going to do a festival, 2 festivals in one day, and then do an after party that same day, you know? So it that kind of ties into kind of the health question you were talking about, like literally touring went from 0 to 100, if not 110%. Like it was, we're everywhere. We're living on buses. We're flying everywhere. We're never slowing down. I mean, we were doing, soon as I jumped on with Caked Up and started rolling into electronic, easily doing 150 to 200 shows a year in every type of touring capacity you can think of. Buses, vehicles, flying, more flying than anything else, but living in and out of airports and doing shows that same night. There was a lot of, we would do 2-3 shows in a day and then go straight to the airport after the show, after our last show. So we would sleep beyond 30 minutes of sleep and go right to the airport and then all over again. Like at least on a bus, you can sleep and you wake up at the venue the next day. Like flying, we had no end to it. So, I mean, we just repeat. We literally just fly from one city to the other and do, you know, full 20-hour days at sometimes and not even sleep and then go straight to the airport and leave. So
there was this one DJ that I met in Miami like a couple years ago, and he was just like, just told me kind of like what his schedule was like. And I was like, what? I'm like, how, as a human being, how do you survive that?
We're totally superhuman. I don't know how I survived it. Like I never thought my point in my life, like definitely there were some tough drives in my earlier days of driving bands, driving overnight after the gig, after sleeping in a dressing room was tough, but pulling all nighters or traveling everywhere to get to your gig, or, you know, flying to get to your gig, then doing everything that comes with the show day, then the other shows that are tacked on to that. Sometimes they're tacked on the day of. Like, oh, we have a full show day with X, Y, and Z components that are going into this event. Could be loading in major production and it's a major show. Okay, cool. Midday. Oh, we're playing an after party as well with all of this that's involved that needs to be done. And that's not going to be done till 5 a.m., 6 a.m. because in electronic music, we're, and that's another thing with Band World, most shows are ending before midnight, probably 10 p.m., 11 p.m. And that's it.
Yeah. Then you have the afters till noon the next day.
Yeah. Like, ah. Said and done. You know, and electronic, like, we never slept and we never slowed down. I mean, our foot was on the throttle the whole time. Like, it never ended. And there's a lot of politics around placement and DJs trying to grow and come up in the scene because there was just so many DJs coming in this huge wave that it was just like, we really needed to be out there. We needed to be seen. We needed to play every gig that we could play, and that we really kind of relying on the live sector of that, because a lot of this music was now being funneled into the live concert circuit for the first time. You know, a lot of like the wave, you know, like I know that there had been some shows, whether it was with like Coachella, like Daft Punk, and like some things that were kind of more integrated and like electronic was starting to kind of make its wave in. But like, for me personally, I felt like the wave was like 2012 on, was like EDM is like here, you know, like every festival has EDM now, you know, more festivals are catering towards the late night scene versus like seeing bands during the day and the headliner ends at 12 and everyone goes to their campsite. Right. That's kind of like the normal standard of a music festival model. Now it's like DJs play all night. Headliner plays ends at 11. And then you have the electronic stage that goes until 4 in the morning and the festival site doesn't even close down. You know?
That was amazing. I love hearing about all of that because it really does. It blows my mind to even just like picture how people are able to live their life. Because if I don't go to bed by 10 p.m., I can't function. So
I think I'm a permanent night owl. Even with no alarms and us being in our current time right now, like I feel like I'm permanently scarred as a night owl. Like I'm just,
I guess so.
So
tell me how you survive. Like, how is it that you are a living, breathing human being right now? And people who do the job that you do, people who are involved in that part of the business where, I mean, it's literally like round the clock at times. How do you guys survive? Is there anything that you place a lot of importance in that keeps you running?
Well, yeah. After kind of navigating how extensive the electronic touring circuit is, it really pushes you to boiling points that you never thought was possible, right? That you as a human could possibly do on the road. And I've seen a lot of friends that didn't have prior experience coming into electronic, and they aren't tour managers anymore. It was a lot. I'm very thankful for my earlier touring days because that conditioned me to kind of understand what you need to do and how you need to show up for the scheduling around touring and things like that. Taking a break for yourself is important, that you need to take a step off the track. And a lot of people early on want to just keep racing, right? You want to stay on the track. You want to keep going because you feel like if you take a break, someone's going to pass you up. So it's very competitive. People don't want to fall into the dark. People want to stay in the light and they want to keep moving forward and forward. And I think that's the biggest realization that I came to as I got into like 2017, 2018. I really pushed myself to the limits. I was really at a point where I was like, if you ain't first, you're last mentality. It really kind of gotten to that point where I felt like my ego was starting to kind of creep out a little bit. And that was worrisome to me, that I was like, we were just touring, like, you know, my clients were just, our schedules were crazy. It was like we were rock stars. I mean, we were like playing Coachella. We had Billboard traveling with us. We were in between. We were playing Red Rocks. I mean, it was just like crazy touring and just really big shows. And I had just personally felt like I had been pushed to my limits. And that was kind of a breaking point for me, that I was like, this is a lot and it's overwhelming. And my health, I hadn't really paid attention to through this experience, you know, at least through 2017, 2018, my health had gotten out of hand and I took the entire year off. I I took the year off and focused on my health. I was in Nashville by this point, by the way, to kind of put context on it. I had moved from Austin to Nashville, and I lost over 80 pounds and got my health back in gear.
So during that 1 year that you took off and you were living in Nashville?
Yeah, I lived in Nashville for a couple years and took a year off to really focus on my health and get it back in check. Dieting was very off the grid, in the gym every single day. I went from being a tour manager practically to a personal trainer. I was like, okay, if I'm going to put all my passion and heart into this, I can take that energy and I'm going to put it in my health. And I really grabbed the wheel on that and got my diet in check and got my health down by the end of the year, and was able to refocus and check myself. And so everything from there gave me such more clarity and purpose and a realization that we need to take time for ourselves to take care of ourselves, our mental and physical. And that I think more artists are understanding of that now, that even for themselves, touring can really wear you out. Touring can take it out of you. And if you don't take time to work on yourself and focus on yourself, it can really throw you overboard. So that's kind of the best advice I can give, is that don't be afraid to take a pit stop. You know, like we need to be strong. We need to be strong not only for ourselves, but for our clients. And that if we're jaded and burnt out and that we pushed ourselves to a breaking point, we're doing no good for anybody. You know, it's like we got to take time to reflect and recharge our batteries, you know, taking that time in Nashville was a big taking a step back and recharging. And then Soon as I got that in gear, got right back on tour and never slowed down all the way into where we are today. So literally I took that time off to focus on my health. And as soon as I kind of got those goals knocked out off my checklist, I went right back on tour and finished out all the way till 2020. And surprisingly toured this year. I did a bus tour this year, so I'm very thankful for that. That it seems like years ago, but was living on a tour bus this year earlier in 2020. So,
wow. Yeah. But so how nice, right? Like because sometimes it is really scary to just like let yourself slow down, because you're like, oh, like my world could fall apart if I do that. But, you know, to let yourself and then, you know, finally feel like a better person when you come out of it. And then, I mean, the fact that you seem so happy, like like for what you did after your year off.
100%. So, way.
Yeah.
My batteries were at 100%, like brand new human being, molded, sculpted, back in shape, like full reset. I was, in my eyes, I was like, I'm a rock star for me. And if I can, you know, say anything, that there's so much meaning to that you need to be a rock star for yourself, you know? And, if you lose sight of that, everyone loses.
Yeah. And you have to take care of yourself in order to be able to take care of other people, because, you know, nobody is going to want to be around the guy who's literally living in hell because he doesn't take care of himself. You know, like if it's time for you to slow down and take a step back and get yourself back to where you were in a better place before you get to a place where it's all negative, that's even better. So that's really nice. I'm really happy for you. And I'm so excited for, you know, what comes after this, because now the entire industry had a little bit of a break. And I know that it's frustrating. And I know that a lot of people are, you know, are struggling in lots of ways. But I really do think that it's kind of, you know, if you look at the silver lining,
yeah,
you know, there's that little bit of forced time off that some people really, they can't give themselves.
I went right back to 2017. You know, as soon as this happened, I go, you know exactly what you need to do. I was like, focus on your health, keep up your studies, find a way you can keep giving back during this time, try to make a difference, but make a difference for yourself. And I think that's the biggest thing is that we need to really kind of focus on that self-care, and that's going to take us so much further. And my co-host will laugh. I always just say I'm the baby of the group. You know, I've got so many years ahead of me. I've got 20 more years if you can give it to me. But there's so much to learn, and we never stop learning. And I'm so thankful to have been learning from everyone at Tour Management 101 and to all my co-hosts there, and to just keep tightening up and get better and hopefully come back another new evolved tour manager ready to take on the touring world if that day comes, you know.
Well, staying hopeful. When it comes, it will come. So you told me about when it started taking off around like 2014.
Yeah. So 2014 was caked up, which was, you know, I was very fortunate to come in with these clients as they were having their big year, I like to call it, right? They've got a lot of buzz. They've had a lot of big tracks come out. They've got a great team behind them. They're making great traction. They're literally booked on every music festival and tour that they can be thrown on. And I was thrown into the wildfire like that. Like that, it was crazy. There wasn't like, we're building a tour and this is what it's going to be like. It was like, this tour is built. This is like a built machine. Like you're coming in and you're grabbing the wheel and you're rolling with it. And it was like, we were playing everything, you know, we were touring with big acts as direct support. We had done the Steve Aoki bus tour, which was such a major tour, and was just like, wow, okay, we're touring with Steve Aoki, and like that's a big deal. And there was a huge bass tour going on. It's called Safe and Sound, and that was a really major bass tour going on around that time. We were on that, so there was a lot of bus touring going on right off the bat, and between that, it was all flying. So that's another intricacy with DJs, is that we could be on a bus tour, but then we're flying and doing gigs right off that bus and flying right back into that bus.
So you're on a major tour that where you're direct support for this tour that's already built, correct?
Yeah.
And then there's buses involved there, but then you guys go off to do like your own shows?
Our own thing as well. Oh. So that was when we started to get more exposed to like how, and I don't like to use the word intense, but how these artists can be everywhere all at once. And we literally had no strings attached, right? Like I'm used to being like, we're in a vehicle, we're going from point A to point B, and like, this is the gig we're playing and that's it, you know? And then when I crossed over into electronic, it was like, you could be here today and you're there that same day, and then you're flying over there, and then you're back on the bus, and then you're doing this full, we could do shows all across America before even going back to the bus. Like, I mean, we'd fly and reroute it from flying, and then fly back for the bus dates, and then fly and keep doing that, you know? So it was definitely a more, the schedule and travel was a lot more. That was, the travel's amped up significantly.
Did anyone warn you about that?
Not really. I mean, I kind of got the rundown of the client, and was like, this is kind of the things we need you to handle. This is what I kind of got, like the rundown. It's like, this is what your tour manager kind of role is going to be like. These are the things we handle as management, because some management companies are more hands on and have their own system in place. And they'll be like, we need you to handle X, Y, and Z, versus like some management companies are like, you're our tour manager, we don't want to handle it, you go handle it, you know? So there was like, I was briefed like that, but it wasn't like, oh, and your travel's about to be crazy. It was just like, you're now doing 5 to 6 flights a week, and that's a normal thing. You may never go home. There was times I just never went home. I mean, we just lived in airports. I had this funny meme I posted forever. It was just, no home anymore. Just living in airports forever. Like, never leaving.
What was the picture?
Gigs forever. I think it was like, I'm trying to think. It was like Frank Sinatra, like smoking a cigar in an airport or something.
Very like matter of fact.
Yeah, you know, just it's so ridiculous. But other tour managers can relate. You know, some of these travel schedules get so crazy that, you know, half the time my stuff just lived in a storage unit, and it was that busy. It made no sense to really live anywhere other than on the road. And my artist at the time, they were all based out of Vegas. So they just had me come fly to Vegas and stay at their, they had an extra guest bedroom. So I was just like living in Vegas for a bit. So that was kind of nice. Yeah. And then, you know, one thing would step up to the other, and it's just more gigs and more opportunities and buses. I would move from Caked Up to Snails. My last gig with Caked Up would be Lollapalooza 2015. And then I would move over to Snails, who was also having a big year. You know, he was having a big year rolling on a lot of music. He had released some stuff with Jack U. For people who don't know who that is, that's Diplo and Skrillex. So they had a big wave going on around that point. And so it was a really big deal for him to be involved with them. That was like huge. The Jack U thing was really big. And so we had a lot of buzz around that, and we're just touring went even faster off of Caked Up, and it just never slowed down. And it just kept rolling, you know, all the way through 2017. It was just a lot of big years and just a lot of big moments. And the experience was just something I'll never forget forever. I mean, it was such a pinnacle point in understanding that kind of fandom around artists and that kind of level of events, and would eventually find my way starting to go international. So for me, getting into that, going international was like moving to Austin, Texas for me, right? I got my first passport. I was like, I'm never going to do a gig internationally unless I really kind of envision it. So I got my passport without even having a gig locked, and would eventually get my first gig to go international with Snails. And then my travels started breaking out of North America. So up to this point, I had only done gigs in the United States up until 2015 going into 2016. And that's when things started to shift gears on a more worldwide scale, where the demand and doors were starting to get opened around the world for this kind of music. And then we just started living internationally, and things started getting really crazy from there. So
at this point, now you're traveling all over the world, and you've already traveled all over the US. How do you keep track of that stuff? Like, you said you're into art. So is that kind of a way that do you collect things from different places? Like, do you go to museums? What do you do?
It's unfortunate that this is a podcast, but I will do my best to really paint a picture for you. I'm such a experience hoarder. It's a problem. You know, whether it's magnets or merch shirts, you name it. If I can get my hands on it, if it's associated with the festival or the event or the tour that we are on, probably have it in my place for my entire timeline, essentially. I would even go as far as add it to the rider. So the promoter would look at the rider and go, all right, we need booze, we need food. All right, we need magnets, and we need art as well. So I added those things with approval from management, being like, hey, this is kind of a cool little miscellaneous thing. Are you cool with it? Artist was cool with it. So we started putting down all the magnets from every single city, and the art for the event, the official art of the event, poster for whatever event or festival or tour we're doing. And so 10 years later of that, a lot has been collected. you know, even if you can look right behind me, I mean, you won't see it on the podcast, but you can see just this piece alone is, you know, you've got my like laminate pieces. And if anyone's been on Tour Management 101, you can kind of see a fuller picture of this back wall. But, you know, you got art from my earlier beginnings as a fan all the way to, you know, my first laminate. You know, when I mentioned Boombox, the first tour I ever got, that laminate's in there. It's super cool. I mean, I'm such a nerd. So I've done really well with keeping the memories of my story. And, you know, it's so funny. Some people are like, why do you do this? I've gotten so much slack from some people. And it's because I never took this life for granted. And I knew that we were doing something very special that not a lot of people get to do in their life. Yet alone get to travel the entire world and experience the worldly cultures on top of producing music in these countries. It's insane. I was like, this is crazy. Like, I don't know if I'll ever do this ever again in my life. I mean, I hope, but I'm, you know, I, just very thankful that life was able to come full picture like this. And so I never took that for granted. So every little magnet and ticket and passport stamp I could get, you bet I got it. It's here at my place. So, and going back to art, you know, I started collecting art as a fan. So I already knew kind of the importance of art collecting and how unique they are to each show. They're like signed, they're limited edition, they're done by a unique artist in that city, or for event or special festival, you name it. And when I started touring, I was like, this is just the next chapter of collecting art, you know, and put it in there. And some promoters fulfill it, some don't, but for the most part they did. So I'm thankful now I have literally every event practically that I've done in art here on me. So it's a lot. It's a lot of art, but I'm such a nerd and obsessed with it. And I'll show it to you sometime if you'd like to see my art collection.
Yeah, that is so cool.
Such an art geek. You know, I'll probably tell you probably the craziest one I have from work is Coachella 2019. Or is this last year? Yeah. Yeah. 2019. Yeah. Okay. Coachella 2019. There was an edition done by EMIC, who's just a big concert festival artist based out of Portland, Oregon. Don't hold me for that. I'm pretty sure he's based out of Portland, but he does a lot of the Coachella prints and he does a lot of major music festivals across the US. His art is like really sought after and he's a big artist. We played Coachella last year and I went and his work was there. He had two editions done. There's two different color variances. I had gone kind of behind the merch booth to talk to the guy and was like, is there anything else? Like there's gotta be, was there a special edition done or anything like that? And he goes, let me go and check. He goes, there was a 5 editions done only of that print in foil for the owners of C3. And they only took 4. So we'll give you,
nice.
We're going to give you the 5th one. And I got the 5th one and that's it. There's only 5 of them. So for the 20th anniversary Coachella print that was done specifically for the owners of Coachella, they have them and I have one.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Put that in like a prized frame.
I think it's crazy. I mean, it's 5 for 5. I mean, there's so many big acts and just so many people involved with that festival for a 20th anniversary for the head honchos to have it. And I have the 5th one. It's kind of wild to me.
That is really cool.
It's cool for me. You know, I thought it was crazy. I was like, how is this even a thing? How do I have this print? So
no, that's super cool. I have a record. It's like the Nico, like the one with the banana, the Andy Warhol, the Velvet Underground.
Yeah.
But when I worked at WBZ, which is Chicago's NPR station, Sound Opinions, like some of the bigger supporters of Sound Opinions, which was like our radio talk show, they got all these autographed records and it was like a limited amount. I think there were only like 10 of them. And the guy who was in charge of philanthropy, we were friends and he like snagged one for me. And actually, oh, he doesn't work there anymore, so he can't get in trouble. But yeah, so I have it and it's like autographed and it's kind of like my little prized possession because I knew there were only like 10 of them. And
yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I totally get that whole like nerding out about things and nobody else would ever care. You know, it's like,
I'm like one of the few. I mean, I know there's a lot of, everyone likes to collect things, but like, I don't ever hear anyone that's like super advocate about like the posters or like where you need to have them. I was like at the event, like we're at like Bonnaroo or Lollapalooza and we're in the advance. I'm like, we have to have the prints. I was like, the prints are a thing. Like it is a thing. And we got them. We got them at every single event. And like, we're just totally, our whole team would be traveling out of all these festivals with like 5 poster tubes on us every show. you know, we got them, you know, so.
Well, that says a lot about, you know, the importance of keeping a good perspective, because I feel like it's super easy to kind of get in this, you know, it's just your everyday and it becomes normal and you become jaded and it's whatever at some point and you don't think anything's cool anymore.
Yeah.
But if you like, if you kind of have that thing that you're collecting, I guess it does, it can kind of keep that little spark going.
Yeah.
So it's still, you know, and I think exciting.
That goes even as far as like kind of what I was talking about earlier, in the sense that like, how do you give it back to your artist? How do you make this fun? Because a lot of artists get jaded or get worn out and they like to live in studio, or they're introvert and they don't want to be on the road. I try to kind of pour my passions about touring over to them and make them excited about this stuff too. I'm like, dude, like we have to get this print. Like this is like a legit print. Yes, the concert, but the art, we need to talk about it. And they're like, yes, we need this art. We need to get it. We get there and they're like really excited about these things as much as I'm excited about these things. And so it's fun to like, you know, have things that you're really passionate about on tour and like look forward to. And it's like, I look forward to putting on these events and working with these teams and like being a part of these families. But it's also fun when you're like flying five times a week and you like you're in, gone through eight different time zones and you're like trying to kind of keep your morale up. You got to find little things that kind of keep you going. You know, our teams are worn out and beat up, you know, and like it can be tough, you know. So it's good to find little things that really they're the little things in life. How about that? You know?
Yeah, you're totally right. Oh man, Mark. All right. So that was an amazing conversation. I'm so excited to hopefully meet up with you. I don't with this whole COVID thing, I don't know, but I'm excited to maybe see some of your posters.
Yeah.
At some point.
It's such a process, and people don't even realize that like I have over 150 to 200 prints in collection right now.
So where do you keep them?
So I had a gallery that held them for a long time. I would just have them sent to a gallery. Long story short, my mom had a friend that owned a frame shop when I was like senior in high school, and I had some prints from being a fan, and I was like started to collect these prints and I didn't know what to do with them. I was like, they're gonna get ruined, they're gonna get torn up. And I was like, well, go talk to my friend at X, Y, and Z frame gallery shop and see if they'll do something with it. And they were like, we'll store them for you. We'll put them in museum sleeves and hold them for you. And they held them for me till last year. There was like a fire at the building next door. And they were like, we don't want them to get ruined or some emergency happens, so on and so forth. But they stored all my art and held onto those pieces for almost 15 years. Crazy. They've been a part of this story as much as I've been in my entire life in music. Like they were there getting the first fan pieces of art that I ever got ever, and have seen the art timeline change from me being a fan to me working in music to my full-blown career in music. Like they've seen that whole evolve.
Why don't you put on a show once this whole thing is over and just put them all on display and invite all of your friends and all of your family?
Oh my God,
and show them the journey. And then you can play this episode of the podcast and show them your journey in the industry.
If someone wants to help me do it, that is on my bucket list. Like I want to get a warehouse and I want to be able to display them, hopefully in order. But I managed to track down just about every print from every show and festival that I've either gone to as a fan or done. I'm on an art community forum called Espresso Beans, where you can put down your collection and you can put down pieces that you're looking for, trade if it comes on the market, so on and so forth. So I've used that site to practically track down every single piece that I've been involved with, and it's a crazy and beautiful thing. Like when I open it up, it's like you're like, wow. Like this is a lot, and this is so cool.
Well, it's happening. It's done. It's happening. So we're gonna have some audio samples. People can put on headphones and listen to your story while they walk through the story. And then, do you ever take photos when you're on the road?
I do. Yeah. I try to, I take photos on the road for sure. I mean,
yeah, you can throw some of those in there.
Yeah. Too many, photos on the road, especially when we're traveling international, you know, always trying to take shots of memories and things like that. So, yeah.
Awesome. That's so fun. All right. Well, let's do that. Let's put a pin on that. And one day we will retell the story of Mark Clark. Here are some key takeaways from my conversation with Mark Clark. 1. When you don't know which way to go, follow your instincts. When you feel something pulling you toward your future, listen to that feeling and trust your gut. 2. Depending on your schedule, you may be driven to push yourself to the brink of exhaustion. It's important to take a break before you break. 3. Be a rock star for yourself. If you lose sight of that, everyone loses. 4. When you take time off or are forced to take time off, focus on your health, focus on your studies, find a way to give back and take care of yourself. And 5. Document your adventures. Keep tokens of shows so that you can look back at them when you need a reminder of why it is that you do what you do. Thank you so much for joining us on the Tour Life podcast. Be sure to give Mark a follow on Instagram at MarkClarkTM. And don't forget to like, subscribe, leave a review on iTunes, and to follow the Tour Life on Instagram at the Tour Life podcast.